This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Southwest Michigan's second wave has been exploring Kalamazoo's Edison neighborhood. In one of the stories, writer Mark Waddell introduces us to Esto Juarez. We read about his troubled teenage years and his commitment to a better life for himself, his family, and others. Thank you both for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Mark, I'm going to begin with you. There's a lot of stories you can do in the Edison neighborhood. Mm-hmm. What drew you to Esto?
Well, I've lived in the Edison neighborhood on Lane Street since 2004. My wife and I bought a house there. And as you read in On the Ground, on Second Wave series On the Ground, Edison is a very diverse place where you got every type of human being living there, except for the wealthy. I don't know if we have any wealthy there. But I ride my bike around a lot. I'm an avid bicyclist, and I ride often through Washington Avenue, where the Washington Street Boys were said to own. And I've often wondered if I should be worried about that. It just feels like another world there. And Esto's laughing. I ride through like a nerd with my helmet on, even. I wear a helmet. Anyway, I've written about a lot of different things, arts and entertainment. I wrote about the Gilmore Fest. I wrote about invasive weed species and things like that. And when On the Ground started, I thought this is a chance for me to write about something in Edison. And I went to the meeting, the first meeting we had, where my editors and interested community members showed up to say, you know, here's what we should do with On the Ground. And Esto was there. He mentioned his story. And I thought, I want that story. I want to cover that story. I want to write about it.
So Esto, you were chuckling there as Mark was describing riding his bicycle. Did he have some reason to be worried riding through those parts of Edison?
Yeah, a little bit. I think part of it is just because I'm so used to the neighborhood and growing up on that street, to hear somebody from a different perspective kind of chime in on what their experience is. So it's a little funny to me, yeah.
Were you part of the Washington Street Boys?
Yep. So when I was younger, I actually started the Washington Street Boys. That was in my former life. It's more of a street gang, territorial, nothing too big, not organized or anything like that. But yeah.
As you were going through that time in your life, did you think this is not going to end well? Or did you think at some point, I've got to make a change? Or were you thinking this is just the way I'm going to live?
Mm-hmm. So I think there's like a couple components to that. One of the things that I believe that happens within the context of neighborhoods like that is you're a product of your environment, right? And you only will do what you've learned and what you've seen, right? And so part of it is that sometimes we believe the narrative to be that one of, well, this is just the way life is, and we accept it as it is. Never in my thought process, I would think that, well, maybe one day it'd be better. You're so entrapped and entrenched in that thought process, and you're not thinking past, you know, the couple days, right? The next day or the day after that. And so with that kind of narrative, being from the street and being part of a gang, there's only two outcomes, right? Usually. There's prison, which usually ends in you being there for the rest of your life, or death. And so those were two actually real scenarios that were possibly the outcome of my life. But I think what changed that and kind of changed the trajectory of my outcome or my story was somebody took time and came and was sharing the gospel with us, right? Somebody came and loved us where we were and showed God's love in a practical way. And it sounds really like, well, that, you know, how does that make sense? God's practical. Well, God is practical, right? For me, it was that somebody actually cared for us and somebody was actually pouring time and taking the time and being consistent with it that caused the change in my life.
Is there one particular moment that stands out to you when things turned around, or was it more of a gradual process?
I think it's both and, right? Because the ongoing prayers and support and this individual coming and being consistent with, you know, just showing God's love in a practical way to us, and loving us where we were, was like part of the process of seeing the transformation. But there was actually a moment in my life when, so I tell people I'm not religious, but I have a strong faith and I'm very spiritual, right? So the day that Jesus became real to me was when I was in a time where I was addicted to crack cocaine for about 4 years. And it was like I was so enslaved to that that I didn't have any kind of thought process on how to get out of that, right? So I remember calling my friend. His name is Nate Bull. And we were talking, and he just would encourage me to pray, you know, and try this thing that I otherwise deemed that I didn't like or didn't believe. But I didn't really try it, you know, to the point where I actually could say, well, this is something I want. So then I prayed, and I remember praying. I remember asking Jesus, deliver me from this addiction. I remember saying in that prayer, if you would deliver me from this, I will consider your ways. And it was one of the craziest moments in my life because it happened. And then the following days, it was like I was angry, upset, sad, joyful, confused, all at the same time, because it was like, what happened? And there is nothing to give the credit to but God, because I remember those past days, you know, it was me praying and asking God, deliver me from this addiction. And it was the very thing that he did.
Now, we had a question. My editors and I wondered if I should have asked specifically, was it like that? No more addiction?
Instantaneously.
Okay.
Instantaneously.
Cold turkey.
Cold turkey. The withdrawals, the cravings, the all that, you know, just gone. It was gone. And like I said, those feelings were real. Like I was scared, I was mad, I was sad. Because in my mind, I was like, whoa, God, why did it take you this long to do this for me? But I think it got to a point where it was where I was in life, the brokenness that I was in, and the authenticity of wanting to be different, right? And a combination of other things too. So, I mean, the prayer support and stuff like that.
I recently did an interview with someone regarding addiction who is now high up in the federal government working on this issue, and we talked about wounded healers, people who've been through addiction themselves. And then come out the other side and they want to help other people. I mean, did you go through something of a similar thing there? Because now you are someone who is involved in ministry and trying to preach to people who are, you know, perhaps where you were at in your teenage years.
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that I feel like the Lord is using me as an example, right? So when I speak to people, I'm able to speak to people from the context of saying that, like, look, you know, I was here and I was wrapped up in bondage and this is what it looked like for me. But now I'm here because, you know, I was free from this. So sometimes people, like, I like to think about how God works in our lives in a couple of different ways. The transformation and renewal of our mind happens when we apply a truth or an information to our lives. So if we receive information and we don't do nothing with it, transformation can't happen, right? So in Romans 12:2, it says, do not be conformed to the ways of the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, right? And so a lot of times people just receive the information but never apply it, right? And so God still gives us a responsibility to act upon what he's given us, the resources that he's given us to live free from these things, right? And so part of my story is being an example for people, continuing to pray for people, and walking with people through these struggles. At the end of the day, people just want to be loved. You know, if they can feel that ultimate love, then it changes so much. In the scripture, Jesus comes into a situation and loves people right where they're at. He doesn't tell them, well, you need to receive my theology or understand my doctrine or follow me first. Right? It's just the act of love that kind of transforms people.
Describe the work you're doing now with Urban Alliance.
So Urban Alliance is a pretty cool organization. It's part of how I can put my faith into action. Like, I believe that sharing the gospel is part of that. But helping people in their everyday needs and the things they need to be sustainable and have successful lives are things that we also need to consider as being the church, you know what I mean? So Urban Alliance offers different programming, which one is called Momentum, which is a workforce development program, 6 weeks long. You get a coach, you got to do 100 hours community service, and it's soft skills to get you ready to be employed. And so part of that is finding the right fit for you and getting people into, like, not just minimum wage jobs, but like $13, $14, $15, $16 an hour type of jobs. You know what I mean? Careers more so than anything. That's a portion of Urban Alliance. What I do at Urban Alliance, I'm the director of outreach there. And so that consists of a couple of different things, right? And so one of them is street outreach, where we go and we share the love of Christ with people. And we just love on people, right? And we tend to get the heartbeat of the neighborhood, right? So the more we can understand the community, the better we can bring about the resources to help change the community, right? We're not going to save anybody at the end of the day. We want to empower people, embrace them, and engage them to lift, to give them a hand up, right? Not a handout. And so there's some other components like initiatives. GVI is one of those initiatives that I'm working on. It's the Group Violence Initiative. And that's with the City of Kalamazoo, Police Department, Goodwill Industries, where we're looking to help. So our goal is to keep people alive, get guns off the streets, and keep people out of prison, right? At the end of the day, that's our goal, but we want to be able to support some of these individuals who are involved in these activities, right? Like high-risk shooters and violent offenders, and kind of give them the support they need, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, they're just a product of their environment, and they're only doing what they've been taught.
So, Mark, you talked to some people from the Kalamazoo Department of Public mm-hmm. Safety about some of the work that ESTO is doing. How much do they value the fact that they've got someone there in Edison like ESTO?
Oh, they value him a lot. Pastor ESTO was, what was the quote? He's a good dude. He's someone they need. Because the police officers that I talked to, they primarily in our society have just a couple jobs, either stop a crime from happening, or if it happens, find out the perpetrator, bring him to justice. You know, it's a very simplistic brute force way to fix a problem. And when we talk about fixing a problem, that puts us in the mindset that we have to fix a problem. This person is a problem. He's in the gang. The only way to fix him is to put him in the court, put him in jail, put them in prison. And I think the Council of Public Safety see this, they see this operation, the people like ESTO, as something very valuable they can do. ESTO and other people can do things that the police just can't. Police can't walk into a situation with their uniform on and say, we're going to try to get you a job. That's just not what they do. I think the figure I got was that violent crime has gone down, shootings specifically, I think, has gone down 63%. I'd have to check that, but that's what's happened in the past couple of years.
But so is someone like ESTO, do the police almost view him as a liaison in a way that, you know, he may not be really doing police work, but he's doing some of the intermediary sort of things that maybe make their job just a little bit easier at the end of the day?
Well, he's chilling people out, basically. I think that's what we can say, yeah. What I think the value of the police see in this situation. I was talking to ESTO when interviewing him about, you know, the difference between fireworks and gunshots, which is something I wonder about every summer. And the fact is, gunshots have gone down in Edison, thanks to people in the community like ESTO, and don't want to leave the Kalamazoo Police Force out of it, but they've been patrolling a lot, and things have gotten better. And it's all due to people like ESTO just being able to reach out to these guys on the street. I mean, he's got the authority. He's been there. They know him from those days. And somebody who comes in from out of Edison to say, we're going to help you. That's maybe they might not have the authority that ESTO has.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we're featuring a story from Southwest Michigan's Second Wave's On the Ground Edison Project. Mark Waddell wrote the story featuring ESTO Juarez. One thing that's in your story, Mark, and also has been relayed in some other on-the-ground stories from Edison, is that there was a real sort of awakening after Michael Day was shot to death in 2014. What did you hear from people regarding how that might have created more awareness and action about violence in Edison?
Well, that was it just shocked the community, shocked Kalamazoo and Edison. I lived there at the time, and just the thought that a 13-year-old kid just got gunned down in the street, that makes it much more urgent and real to people than, oh, maybe some dudes are selling crack. It's unacceptable. So I think that spurned the group violence initiative and projects like that. And it also, from the officers I talked to, that made them realize that more had to be done to really get at the root of the problem.
So, ESTO, I want to ask you about speaking at Michael Day's funeral in 2014. It's a very gripping part of this story. Tell us what was going through your mind.
It's a real personal one right there. I've known Michael Day since he was a baby. I know his dad and his mother, and I talk to his mother still. You know, we communicate and talk about stuff. But I remember I was living on the east side when that happened, and then I heard about it and rushed to the Edison neighborhood as fast as I could. Like, the thing that kind of goes through my mind as an individual who started this gang, right? I'm not saying Michael Day was part of the gang, but affiliation, you know? I mean, when you're around it all the time, it's just, you're consumed by it, you know? He was never a person who would claim to be part of the gang or to be an active member, right? And so when this happened, it kind of like, it devastated me because part of some of the stuff that I started, this was the residual of it. You know, this is what came and continued to come, right? It was just a sad moment, you know, for a mother to have to lose a 13-year-old son. Like Mark was saying, unacceptable, man, you know? But when you're wrapped up in that kind of mindset as a gang member or from the streets, you really don't think like that. You know what I mean? Your first reactions is retaliation or whatever the case might be. But I think it was one of the hardest things that I ever had to do was to officiate that funeral, right? I watched this boy grow up, you know what I mean? And so part of the reason what I do now with GVI and other stuff is because I tell the homeboys down on the block, like, look, I don't care what you guys think about me working with the police, but if I can keep you alive and out of prison, then I'm gonna do, that's my job, right? Some of them might have ill wills towards me or feelings like, oh, you're working with the police and this and that. And it's like, whatever. I do it openly. It's not like I'm hiding. I tell people, like, yeah, I work with the police to help get guns off the streets, keep people alive, and keep people out of prison, right? And so that kind of drives my passion and my ability to do some of the work that I'm doing, you know. And that's part of why God has me where he has me, is kind of to undo and unravel the things that I've done, right? And so it's a difficult thing when a life is taken, right? It's a hard thing to work through. We're coming up on, I think, the anniversary.
Mm-hmm. It was a Memorial Day weekend.
Yep. Yeah.
Have you lost some friends because you've cooperated with the police, or the people that say they don't want to talk to you anymore, anything like that?
Yes. And yes and no, because to my face, they'd be like, you know, oh, what's up, Esto, what's up? But it, like, behind my back, I can only imagine what people say about me. At the end of the day, you know, it's not what people say about me that drives me or fuels me. It's what God says about me that drives me and fuels me, right? Yeah, there's the naysayers and there's the, you know, the backbiting and all that other stuff that happens. But at the end of the day, you know, I know where God has me and what he has me doing.
So as you say, what happens around gang activity is often people being the product of their environment. Do you think that what you're trying to do is change that environment in some way to make it a different sort of place than it was when you were growing up?
Mm-hmm. You know, people live into these narratives that have been written for them. And part of, I think, what I want to do is just to be an example, one, right, to live it out. So people can say, look, man, Esto was the heart of the hardest, right? He was the worst of the worst. But look where he's at now. You know what I mean? That's part of it, right? Is just to be a living example in the midst of the chaos, right? So where I live now is right where the gang was started. So I live two houses down right from where the gang was started, right? On Washington Street. 3 years ago, my son was shot in the leg in a drive-by with a 9mm, right? And it was a tough time for me and my wife to go through. It was really hard because, you know, in we tend to attach the character of God to the scenarios of life. And we say, well, where were you, God? Or why'd you allow this to happen? And we don't realize that God remains the same, right? He's faithful and he remains the same. And what we go through in life doesn't dictate who God is, right? And so that was a challenging time for me, but it helped me be more aware of, you know, who are the people fighting for these causes? Who are the ones speaking out, you know, against these injustices, right? Who's going to be the one that brings the accountability, right? And speaks truth and in love, right? At the same time, that kind of helped me understand that there's much more to be done. There's much more to be said. At the end of the day, I just got to continue to keep doing that.
I want to ask you, though, a little bit more about your son being hit by a 9mm bullet. He was 3 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of a lot of people who have moved out of a neighborhood for a lot less than one of their children being hit by a gunshot. Why was there ever a conversation between you and your wife about maybe Edison just isn't the place for someone with young children?
Yeah. It was a crazy time because we moved into the Edison after that happened. So we weren't
after he was shot?
After he was shot, we moved in, right? That following, so it was Father's Day 3 years ago. We went to the lake, we're grilling out, we came back, we unloaded at my aunt's house. This drive-by happened, he got shot. We took him to the hospital. Thank God everything was good, right? He remembers it to this day, and he's got a story. But I was faced with two different scenarios. So at that time, I was still the pastor of the church at Vanguard. And the church, in their minds, were like, oh my goodness, what is Esto going to do, right? Because of my past, you know, averting back and stuff like that was like an option, right? And then I had the streets, you know, all the other gang members and the homeboys from the block asked, what are we going to do, right? So I'm faced with this decision, like, and I'm stuck, right? And I'm like, God, what is it that you want me to do? And this is the crazy part, because I remember there was a reporter from Channel 3 that would just wanted to interview. And I'm like, no, not now. I remember 3 weeks after it happened, the Lord gave us kind of direction, right? And he was like, forgive the individual who did this to you. I said, what? Come on, this guy, he harmed my son, right? And I'm thinking to myself, like, why would you do this, Lord? You know? And so the lady, she called me again. She was like, I want to do an interview. I said, okay. We did a live interview, and I said, I told her, and me and my wife told her, like, we forgive the individual who did this, right? Because we know that he is broken. He is in a broken state, right? And he needs just as much as I need the love of Christ, right? And Christ died for him just as much as he died for me, right? And we tend not to think like that because it's like the horrible things that people do, right? me and my wife, we knew 3 weeks following that event that God was calling us into the neighborhood for a purpose and for a reason. And so the house was being renovated. It was being, we're working on it. We had it all gutted out and everything, right? And we're about like 60% done with the house. And then this happened. But the church was like, no, you can't move into the neighborhood. My mother-in-law was like, no, you can't move into the neighborhood. People were like, no, you can't. That it's not safe. I said, I'd rather be where God wants me to be. Because I know where he wants me to be is the safest place I could ever be.
Mark, I want to come back to you and ask a little bit about, as you say, you are someone who actually own a home in Edison. Mm. You've lived there for a while. What does this story say to you? And maybe what would you like it to maybe say to other people about what Edison is? And does that maybe combat some things that you think are unfair images that people have of Edison?
Well, I have to mention that my background is basically middle-class farm boy. My family owns Waddell's Nursery. I grew up on the nursery out in Galesburg. I grew up pulling weeds with, I don't know if the phrase redneck is rude, but a lot of people who would call themselves that. And if I were to talk to them now, say I live in Edison, they would be like, why are you there? And they have various prejudices, but you know, I was kind of worried about the crime situation. When we moved in, there would be people walking down the street. They'd be looking at my house, and I'd be wondering, why are they looking at my house? And I remember one time, literally, there was some drug selling at the corner. But that's the image. The bad things are the image of Edison. Edison is a very diverse place. My area is pretty quiet now. You get to live in a place and you know that there are bad individuals, bad houses, but mostly where I'm at, it's quiet. People like our photographer, Fran Dwight, live down the road. Me and my wife, these seniors who live across the street, there are people all over doing their best to live in an actual neighborhood. But it's so diverse. Like I said, I could ride my bike down and be really worried about Washington Avenue, and wonder if the fireworks are gunshots and things like that. But the Kalamazoo Public Safety figures that I got say that it's getting better. And I think that the example of people like Esto show that we don't have to live in that world where, you know, we're white, middle class, and separate, or we're Hispanic of the streets, and we have to be in the gang or in prison. No, we can change ourselves. We can get to know each other and learn how to make this thing work that's called the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the cool things about this series is one of the things we decided to do, what my editors decided to do, is like, let's just talk to people in Edison as a neighborhood. So I think people who don't live here, they still might not understand why someone like me or someone like Esta would stay, but we're staying. It's comfortable. Mm-hmm. It's
home.
Yeah.
Mark and Esto, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mark Waddell's story about Esto Juarez is part of Southwest Michigan's Second Waves On the Ground Edison series. You can find those stories at their website. There's also links available at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.